Welcome to the Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. We speak with Queen's Counsel, trial lawyers and judges from around the world about how they excel in the courtroom. Please subscribe on your favourite podcast platform and visit us for additional resources at theadvocacypodcast.com.
I'm your host, Bibi Badejo. In this brief yet potent episode, we welcome legal writing experts Ross Guberman and James Rapley KC, who will shine a light on the art of written advocacy. From writing with intellectual verve to keeping it short, sharp, and to the point, these insights will guide you in crafting compelling arguments that resonate.
We, of course, read Lord Denning doctrinally. You know, that's one of my concerns about the way the law is taught, is you're never really even prompted to explore the way judges reason through opinions, right? We read them for the content, right? So we can spot the right issues on the exams. So Lord Denning is certainly a beacon, I think, in this realm. There are others. I've been reading this Irish justice. I've been reading a bit of his writing lately, also fantastic. But of course, in the United States, Justice Scalia, Justice Kagan, Chief Justice Roberts, certainly those three. And then we do have, on the advocacy side, we have, you know, we're very much a celebrity culture here. That even permeates appellate advocacy and trial work. There are stars and celebrities with, looks like, PR teams quietly on retainer. So there's some really great advocates here as well. Paul Clement is the one name people cite a lot, but there are quite a few others too. And then I've also studied the work of the Office of the Solicitor General, which is the federal government entity that represents the United States. The common thread is there's a certain joyousness in the prose. It's joyousness about kind of intellectual happiness or verve that manifests itself at the level of words and phrases. So that can vary from person to person, but there's a certain spirit. There's an energy, you feel it, but the energy is not rhetorical. It's not energy attached to snide attacks on other judges or lawyers. It's a little bit of fun, right? And of course, you need to have a lot of confidence and have completely mastered the substance of what you're writing about in order to convey that spirit. That's what I see kind of linking all these people from various jurisdictions and eras and people in different roles, is that kind of verve. My general experience, and a little, this is also a little bit my critique about the way legal writing is taught, is there's too much focus on abstractions like sentence length. When someone reads, nobody's thinking, you know, that sentence had 32 words. I'm sure it could have been 29 or 28.5 words. Nobody really, really cares about length of sentences in the abstract. What they're picking up on when they feel like the sentences are long and short is very often not mathematically that the sentences are long and short. It's a feeling, again, of verve and forward motion. So by focusing more on kind of in the affirmative sense, what kinds of words and phrases am I going to cut and trim so that my actual points shine on the page, that's generally your best path to being more concise. I mean, maybe someone so extraordinary at writing, every word they write is already the only word they need. I think our Chief Justice Roberts is maybe a little bit like that, or Justice Kagan over here. But for 99.99999% of us, the secret is ruthlessly trimming, but not in this kind of depressing power struggle way, like, oh, you know, they're just trying to make me cut a page and, you know, they're trying to make me cut my points, or why can't people just read what I have to say and stop being so demanding. More in a positive sense, I'm cutting away the sort of the brush around the points so that my actual points jump off the page. You'll notice that a lot of people, maybe not so much in the UK, but in other jurisdictions, will bold or italicize. It's usually the middle of their block quote. They're trying to draw attention to the part that really matters. Well, guess what? That means the parts that you don't want to bold or italicize probably should have been paraphrased. So one issue is, the argument's not, you know, rigid, yes or no. It's how do I get my point across with the least possible burdening of the reader, the judge? Okay, so number one is, of that language that you are feeling like you want to copy and paste, if you had to whittle it down, either paraphrase or skip it or use language in your actual body, that's issue one. And that already goes a long way. You're making the block quote less onerous. Now, the other challenge is probably more important, the more important of the two. It goes back to our discussion about headlines and why people read or don't read an article, even though they're in theory interested in a topic. So the advocate, the barrister, the lawyer needs to do a little bit of intellectual work so that the reader doesn't have to. So in other words, so-and-so stated, the court said, you know, the witness testified, colon, block quote. The only thing needed for that is copy and pasting skills, right? And identifying, you know, the source. When you have a meaningful introduction to the block quote where you're actually distilling it down to the equivalent of what you'd see in as a heading or headline in an article, you're again, it's kind of like what we discussed in terms of the overall structure as a microcosm. You are now not saying, go read this quote. I'm telling you, it's really important and I want you to read it. You're saying, look, I know you don't want to read this quote. I swear though, it matters and I don't want to paraphrase the whole thing. If you read it, you'll be happy I didn't paraphrase it all. You'll want to see the whole text. But we have to sell the reader on that by having a meaningful introduction, right? So I'm just making this up. You did family court. You know, the father conceded that he never picked the kids up, colon, quote, is far more compelling than subsequently the father stated, colon, big quote, the reader now has to struggle through.
Practice in just refining it and refining it and refining it and saying, well, I can take out those facts. So taking out unnecessary facts, getting rid of dates and times and, you know, who cares, usually, and describing things in a more concise way will do it. Getting rid of big block quotes from cases, they're seldom needed. Sometimes you see like a whole page is a quote from a case. So it better be pretty good and pretty important. Otherwise, you incorporate the point you make in your own paragraph. If the citation, if the point you're making is accepted, then you just make it once with one case, and it's a footnote. You don't need to refer to the facts or the details or what was held about the case. If it's controversial and you're trying to say that the decision is wrong, well, then the situation will be different, won't you? You need to go into the facts and talk about why. And so that does shape it. So you need to work out, what are you using that quote for? What are you using that citation for? Why is it even in there? It doesn't need to be in there. And that'll help get rid of the dross and the volume and the padding. All judges say, you know, what's your point? Get to your point, make your point, highlight your point, and deal with your point. And it does come down to it. So what is this point that you're trying to make? Now, everyone thinks, well, I've got to go through the facts. Well, why do you have to go through all the facts? Are they all really, really relevant? Or, you know, this is a case about boom, boom, boom in a paragraph or two. Here's the key fact that's important. So it does take a bit of time, and using case law, why are you citing the case law, as I said? Secondary authorities and articles, sometimes you get all excited and before you know it, you're citing things from law journals around the world. So what? What's your point? And the point needs to be too, it's not that the author agrees with you, which is normally why most people cite it. It's the prominence of the author that's important, right? That's where people lose sight of it. Who is this person who's written this article? Right? And that's what we know that with the court. It's the court and the judgment and the judge or whatever that's saying those words that you say should be followed or important or listened to them, you know, they make the difference. So just because it happens to be in the New Zealand Law Journal or Cambridge Law Journal for all that, so what? And that's what you need to bear in mind, and then it better be good. And then you just cite it. Those are things perhaps you think about when use quotations, use them sparingly, weave them into your own paragraphs rather than resorting to block quotes. All those keep to that golden rule of short, sharp, and to the point.
Do you want to become a better advocate, but you don't have the time to attend long in-person training courses? If so, the Advocacy Coach Members Club is the perfect solution for you.
Our members-only club gives you access to concise, advanced advocacy courses that you can learn at your own pace on your own time. You'll also get exclusive access to replays of the Advocacy Clinic, our online platform for lawyers to practice their advocacy skills, and a private members-only podcast. In addition, you'll become part of a community of like-minded lawyers who are all committed to becoming better advocates. You'll have the opportunity to network with other members, share ideas, and get feedback on your work. Join the Advocacy Coach Members Club today and start becoming a better advocate on your own time. To find out more and join, go to theadvocacycoach.com/members club. Become unstoppable at court with the Advocacy Coach, your partner in your journey to advocacy excellence.
Thank you for listening to the Advocacy Podcast, Journeys to Excellence. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and visit us at theadvocacypodcast.com for reading lists and other resources. Until next time.